Lord Russell, do you think we've got about the right sort of mixture between capitalism and socialism in Great Britain?
Yes, I do. I think we've got the right mixture for the present time. I don't say it'll be the right mixture forever, because I think circumstances change. But my view has always been, a long time now, that when any particular kind of economic activity has reached the stage of monopoly, it is better run by the state than by private enterprise. And that is about what we've got now in England.
You think this is tolerably fair all round?
Yes, I think it's as fair as you can make it. It isn't perfectly fair, but nothing is.
What would you say are the main virtues of British society?
Well, I should put first and foremost a certain kind of diffused kindliness. I don't say in dealings with people who are not British. That's a different matter. But internally, I think the British are more kindly than most people that I've come across.
Could you explain that a bit?
Yes, I should like to. I don't think they have the same inflexible dogmas that are very common in other countries. And I think partly owing to the fact that we haven't had a foreign invasion since 1066, we haven't got so much reason for savagery in our history as most countries have.
Do you think that the British are better than most other people at devising a good system of justice?
Well, I don't know exactly what one means by justice. Do you mean the law, or do you mean economic justice?
Well, both, really.
I think complete economic justice would be very difficult to get, and is perhaps hardly desirable. I think we've come as near it as one can hope to do, and certainly very much nearer than they've come to it in communist countries, where the differences between rich and poor are much greater than they are here.
What about legal justice and fair dealings?
Well, I don't suppose we're perfect. No country is, but I think we're as good as anybody is.
How about our ability to compromise that we're so proud of?
I think it is perhaps our greatest virtue. We didn't always have it. We didn't have it in the 17th century, and we suffered great troubles in consequence. But in 1688, we decided that we didn't want any more of these troubles, and we adopted the plan of always compromising, which has worked extremely well. For example, when the French Revolution came, French aristocrats were asked, would you rather surrender your privileges or have your heads cut off? And they said, thanks, we'll have our heads cut off. And they did. Whereas in England, in 1832, when the Reform Bill was before Parliament, that involved the surrender of the privileges of the aristocracy. And my grandfather, himself very much an aristocrat, brought in the bill and got it through.
Do you think that the aristocrats of 1832 understood what it was that your grandfather was trying to do for them with his Reform Act?
Well, half of them did and half of them didn't. But the half that did was sufficiently weighty to get the thing through. I think the half that did understood extremely well.
Do you think that's why the upper classes in Britain have gone on making compromises so that they won't lose their privileges?
I think so, yes. To avoid having revolutions and having their heads cut off and all that sort of thing. It's occurred to them that that's what will happen if they're not sensible.
How does this differ from the Continental approach?
The Continental approach is much more doctrinaire. You are for this or for that, and not for getting a suitable adjustment of the two. Now, I can tell you an illustration of that from philosophy. At one time, I was living at Princeton in America, and Einstein lived there. And I used to go once a week to his house and meet him and three other very eminent German intellectuals. There was nothing combative in any of us. But always when we got down to fundamentals, there was a gulf that we couldn't cross. They stood for a certain kind of mystical idealism, and I stood for hard-headed empiricism.
Do you think that tradition has played a large part in Britain's ability to keep herself afloat in a reasonable and stable way.
Yes, I do. I think we like tradition, unless it does some very obvious harm. Now, take, for instance, the question of the naming of streets. In every continental country that I know of, they change the streets every now and again because their politics have changed, and the great men they used to admire, they no longer admire. If we were like the Continentals, we should knock down the Duke of York's column because we don't admire the Duke of York.
What other sort of things we've got in mind in tradition?
All sorts of ways of going on. Formulas that people use in the law courts, or that are used in writs summoning people to Parliament. All kinds of little bits of tradition which most English people very much like and don't want to see swept away.
What about that curious institution of which you are a member, the House of Lords?
Well, the House of Lords, of course, is, I don't know that I could really undertake to defend it because it is so very queer. But I do rather enjoy it all the same.
What about the monarchy? Do you think that plays a large part?
Yes, the monarchy I'm all for, very much for. If you don't have a monarchy, you have to have a president, and it's an awful job electing one. And then anyway, people don't, half the nation doesn't like him, or nearly half. Whereas the monarchy we can all like, and it's much, much preferable. I very much like it better.
Have you always been respectful to the monarchy?
Oh, yes, I started at a very early age. When I was 2 years old, Queen Victoria came to see my people, and they recorded with surprise how very respectfully I behaved to her.
What about history? Do you think that the sense of history in Britain partly stems from the monarchy?
Well, I don't know how much it does, because there's all that sense of history already in the people who were against the monarchy. I read at one time a lot of Roundhead literature of the time of the British Civil War, and they thought then of the aristocracy as Norman and foreign, and they were very much imbued with history, although they were revolutionaries.
Is it important for a nation, do you think, to have a sense of history?
Yes, I think it's enormously important. It gives stability, and it gives depth to your thought and to your feeling.
Do you think we've got that?
We have it in England very much indeed. There's a great deal that encourages the sense of history in this country, and I'm very glad there is.
Would you agree that Britain is one of the most snobbish countries in the world?
Oh, certainly. Well, not quite perhaps the most snobbish that I've ever struck. I've come across a certain amount of snobbery in the Western Hemisphere that seemed to me, if anything, to surpass what I know at home. But certainly there is a very great deal of snobbery in this country.
Do you think it does harm?
It does some harm and some good. I mean, insofar as the people whom the snob admires are better than he is, it does good. Insofar as they're only conventionally better, it does harm.
Can you give an illustration of what you mean by snobbery?
You remember an old fellow of King's in my day, his name was Oscar Browning, and he certainly was a snob. The Empress Frederick came to Cambridge one day, and I regret to say there was another fellow of King's whom she liked better. And Oscar Browning trotted round the university all day, and I met him late in the evening, quite exhausted, and he said, I've been empress hunting all day.
Do you think America will ever become like Britain?
No, I don't, for several reasons. The most important reason is that the proportion of Americans of British descent is continually diminishing. But apart from that, there are other reasons. Well, one is that America hasn't got the same roots in the past that any European country has. Another is that the British who went to America originally were the British who couldn't stand the British quality of loving compromise. They were extremists who couldn't get on at home, and they established a somewhat different sort of mentality from ours. Another is that the early settlers were constantly engaged in fighting the Indians, and that produced a certain strain.
Do you think it matters about Great Britain not being one of the really great powers anymore?
Well, of course, my natural feeling is to regret it. I mean, I have the ordinary patriotic feelings, and I'm sorry in that way, but when I try to think impersonally, I don't know that it really matters very much.
Why do you think it doesn't matter?
Well, I think that the peculiar virtues of the British were more displayed at home than they were abroad. And I don't know that we were so very much better than other people would be in our dealings either with foreign nations or with subject populations. That's one reason. Another reason is that, I suppose there's got to be some nations more powerful than others.
Do you think that the ones that have become more powerful than us will make a better job of it?
No, I don't think they'll make a better job. I hope that, at any rate, America may make as good a job, but I don't expect to see them make a better job.
How do you see the future of Great Britain?
I see the future of Great Britain on the analogy of what happened to Holland. Holland was a great power in the 17th century, and then it ceased to be a great power, but it ceased without disaster and settled down quite well to be a very civilized and a very respectable minor power, and I think that's what we must hope to do.
Could you describe the sort of society that might occur in Britain under this dispensation?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it will go on more or less like what it is at present, with elements of tradition mingling rather oddly with socialistic elements.
Do you think Britain will continue to exert a strong moral influence in the world?
Well, I should like to think so, but that depends upon our politicians, and I don't know what sort of politicians we're going to get.